This is the Science Behind the Art, where we discuss the insights of the cosmetic industry through a different lens, uniting scientists and artists. We are the New York Society of Cosmetic Chemists. I'm Maria.
I'm Regina.
And I'm Leah. Join us as we embrace beauty and dive behind the scenes of the cosmetic industry. Hi, welcome to our podcast, Claims and Emulsions and Polymers. Please meet Dr. Ferris. He started his career in personal care, studying the effect of solvents on sunscreen chemicals. His interest in skin drug delivery, especially from polymeric matrices, grew during his graduate work at Rutgers, where he received his PhD. Dr. Ferris worked at Block Drug and GSK, where he held positions in research and development in the areas of skincare and oral care. After that, he joined L'Oreal, where he held several positions of increasing responsibility, leading to AVP of skincare. He is currently the Senior Director of Skincare and Oral Care at Ashland Specialty Ingredients. Dr. Ferris is the author of many publications and patents and made many presentations in national and international meetings in the areas of sun care, skin care, and oral care. Dr. Ferris chairs the NYSCC Scientific Committee and has won multiple awards in the area of sun care and polymer chemistry. So welcome, Dr. Ferris. Thank you for joining me.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
Thank you. So, just to start, tell me a little bit about yourself. How did you get started in the industry?
So I was actually, entire life was kind of like loved science, right? So when time came to college, you know, I was part of like before even high school, I was always like in the science club and stuff like that. When it came to college, I decided to do, you know, biology and then chemistry. And I finally got a degree in biochemistry and from a bachelor's degree. But almost like my sophomore year or maybe junior year, I said, oh my God, this is where I belong. I have to get my PhD in that regard, you know. Mm-hmm. So I finished my master. I finished my bachelor. Then I joined a master program in LIU in Brooklyn. Mm-hmm. And they had, it was a joint program between, you know, cosmetic science and pharmaceutical science, but I was in the pharmacy program. Mm-hmm. So I was able to get an internship in the summer working in a fragrance company on sunscreen, actually back then, that was a long time ago. And I got excited with formulation. Over there, I met some of my mentors and they actually showed me how to formulate. And I said, oh my God, this is where I need to be. I need to be in formulation. I love this stuff. And then I actually graduated from my master and I insisted to get a job in formulation after that. Then I went and I got a job at Block Drug. Then I went and got my PhD when I was working in the pharma division. And that's where my career started. You know, I got my PhD while I'm working actually. And then I worked for GSK. And then you can see, you know, I moved up and stuff like that. It was interesting.
Yeah, I am very interested in just that career path where it seems that a lot of industry experts begin in some of the unusual areas of science. Some was pharmaceutical, some was actually home and laundry, and then eventually we just ended up just gravitating into the cosmetics realm. So it is quite inspiring that you really never know what path, where that path is actually going to take you, because it's just amazing how we can.
Yeah, it is. But you have to like it. And you're going to feel that you're going to like certain area more than others. Mm-hmm. And if you like them, stick with them, because you should do well in something that you like. That's my recommendation to people. You know, even there are more money in other areas. It's not about money. It's about like what you like, what your passion is, and how can you excel in certain areas.
Right. That is very important and very crucial in any industry, not just cosmetics, but especially more so because we are trying to curate and to create original products that cater to the needs of the consumer. And just to touch on your experience as the senior director at Ashland, what inspired you to actually become a senior director, especially with the career change? And Ashland is a very prominent and a very great raw ingredient company.
As a director, you kind of do a couple of things. One is you try to mentor a lot of people who are like working with you to, you know, develop them, to work with them, to teach them sometimes. You know, that gives you a lot of opportunity with doing that. And that is very satisfying and keeps you coming to work every day. You know, the other thing is it gives you also an opportunity to have your print, your you know, you kind of like shape some of the new molecules that we come up with, you know, have an opinion, you know, have an input on how we develop certain molecule. And that could actually help a lot of formulator out there, you know, because I talk to people in the finished goods company. I come from L'Oreal and GSK. I worked in there. I have a pretty good idea of what they want. And to be able to design new molecules to fill that need, I think that's kind of rewarding for us, you know. So it's two things at the same time.
Ah, I see. Well, that is amazing. So now that you are in such a high level role, were there any particular challenges that you had to overcome once you have got into that role?
You know, it's there aren't many challenges. The thing is, as a scientist, you like to be always connected to the lab. You know, we you go out, you get your PhD, you're excited, you want to do some formulation, you're on the bench, you make stuff, and then you become successful because you're a good formulator, and then they move you up, so you do less formulation, and then you move you up into even less formulation, and at my point you don't do anything. Mm-hmm. And that sometimes, you know, it's all the scientists who actually like to work in the lab kind of like miss it. If you're doing more of a management role, you know, you kind of miss it, but at least you can actually contribute. So it's a different type of contribution. Mm-hmm. But has good impact still. You know, I once in a while I go back where I put my lab coat and make a badge and everybody's making fun of me in the lab. That's fine. but it keeps you going, you know?
Right. And I mean, I do appreciate the transparency of that, because some of us do often forget that once we do move up to senior level roles, I mean, that experience of being at the bench becomes limited. And there will be times where you would miss just that, oh, I have to make 10, 5 batches at a time. But I mean, it was just that love, like, that pressure.
Yeah,
that
you don't have it anymore. Mm-hmm. You're very far. But the only thing is you also have to depend on other people, you know, mm-hmm. and you have to trust them. You teach them how to do things and they take it over from there. So that's like, you know, normal progression, I guess.
Yeah, right. So to actually dive into our topic, which is on claims and polymers, we are a evolving industry. And when it comes to claims and just emulsions and polymers, how would you explain these topics to someone who is not in the industry, who is either just learning or is just curious about how different brands and manufacturers function?
So the claims are basically typically tested on people, right? So if you, for example, I give you an example. For example, hydration, you know, that's an easy test, right? Mm-hmm. Hydration is something that you can test on people. You measure their skin before you apply the product, you measure a certain level of hydration. And then after you apply the product, you measure it. And then you say, okay, that particular product hydrate for, let's say, 8 hours, you know? So that's, you can say, okay, this cream hydrates your skin. Another way of doing it is your skin feels hydrated, right? Mm-hmm. Feels hydrated, that's a different test because you don't really have to do any measurement. You can actually give the cream to product, the product to people and ask, do you feel that your skin is hydrated or not after a certain number of hours? Now, they're both are good and bad, right? Because sometimes customer, you know, they feel hydrated, but if you actually measure it, you don't see any hydration, right? And sometimes also if you measure, but the person doesn't feel like their hand is hydrated, it's something like not really good either, right? Because you have to have that consumer perception. People can talk about hydration in many ways, you know, can talk about rebalancing moisture, you know, what is rebalancing moisture? How could you measure it? People talk about all day hydration. So people have the, for example, think, okay, my God, I'm going to apply that product once a day and then I'm going to have all day hydration. But in fact, if you read the pack, it say apply twice a day. So there are different nuances for the same thing, and people are crafting different terms and testing them differently. So it's a really big field and full of creativity, because that's where like the science comes and works with marketing. Because at the end of the day, you need to market the product to a certain consumer, right? So that message that you create on hydration has to reach out to people with dry hands or certain. So that's where, like, I think the science and marketing comes together, and you can say different things by doing different tests. So it's quite complicated. It's not that simple.
You mentioned that marketing does play a huge role when it comes to our claims and just marketing it to the consumer and getting that consumer perception. In your experience, especially with claims, has there been a lot of misconceptions when it comes to how a product is marketed based off of its claims?
So in depending how you're going to advertise, right, or where you're going to put that claim. So there is a big difference if you put the claim in on the product itself, on the primary panel, what we call the primary panel, or you're going to advertise on TV, right? Mm-hmm. So advertising on TV is also very different than advertising on cable. Mm-hmm. So if you advertise on TV, then you have the FTC behind you. You have the major networks like CBS, this, that, and they will actually look at your data and then make sure that what you're saying on TV is not kind of like, you know, worked up, you know? So there's a lot of regulation with that, and the FTC will come after you. Mm-hmm. If you decide to, you know, to communicate this, you know, on an ad somewhere in a cable or on radio or something with much less audience, you get much less scrutiny, right? But also as a large company, you're going to get much more attention than a smaller company, right? So, for example, a L'Oreal or a P&G, if they put an ad, they're going to get scrutinized by everybody. But if you're, you know, a mom and pop store who's putting an ad somewhere, not many people are going to pay attention to that. So it's there's a lot of scrutiny out there. And I think networks and FTC and companies are very ethical. You know, nobody wants to cheat anybody. I mean, I haven't seen that. They're trying to do their best to have all the data scrutinized and done correctly.
And that's great to hear, because even myself, I'm still in the process of just learning the ins and outs of the industry. And there were some misconceptions that I heard in passing when it comes to how to market and just get that consumer perception when it comes to your claims. And it's still great to hear that the FTC and even brands and just major companies, they still hold that level of class that we don't want to market something that doesn't work, even though profit is, I mean, like people want to make money, but you want to do it ethically.
And usually claims are very reviewed by many people, not just by the scientists, by the marketing, by lawyers, by a lot of bodies, you know, just to make sure that you're conveying the right message. You know, that has been my experience. You know, with the companies I've worked for, they've always been very much scrutinized. You wouldn't say something that's false or anything, you know, because you open yourself to lawsuits. We have to think about
that. That is true. So you definitely have to be careful when it comes to just your claim substantiation. I mean, just transparency is important, but also you still want to market your product that shows that you are the best.
Yeah,
the best,
and that's where marketing people come in. You know, they have, you can say things very, very different and attract people, you know, and that is important. You know, that goes with the package, goes with the formulation. The formulation has to also convey the claim. If you talk, if you have a hydration claim and then you put it on your skin and it just like doesn't feed anything, nobody's going to buy it. You know, so it's a combination of your claim, your package has to be interesting, your formulation has to, you know, deliver. A lot of things happen, you know. Mm-hmm. It's a successful product has a lot of people in it. They have their imprints on it, not just the R&D.
And you mentioned the rheology of a product really does play a role. And I was wondering, is there a trick to creating a perfect emulsion so that you fit the boxes for whatever consumer perception is on trend during at a time?
So when you create a product, you want to know who your consumer is, right? Mm-hmm. So if you're creating, for example, let's say a moisturizing cream for a younger generation, someone between like 20 and 30, right? That's a certain texture. If you're creating this for someone in the 50 and 60, that's a little bit different texture, right? Mm-hmm. Because people have, they like certain texture based on their age, but also based on their, you know, ethnic background, based on also the geography, right? Think mm-hmm. people who are in China, for example, like certain texture. In Japan, they apply it a different way. In the US and Europe, you know, just the fragrance level is different. You know, people in US don't like that much fragrance. In Europe, people like a little bit more fragrance. You know, you can have the same product with two different fragrances, you know? Mm-hmm. You need to know who your customer is, who's going to buy that product, and which person buy that brand. You know, a lot of people are attached to certain brands, you know, so the brand should know who their customer is. Mm-hmm. And that is translated to the formulator. Okay, we need something that is fresh, that is young, that is, you know, breaks quickly, that communicate hydration. And that's one product. But if you're going to create an anti-wrinkle product, then you say, you know, I want something with efficacy that does the cover the wrinkle. And then it's up to the formulator to create it, you know, and that's where the creation comes in. Because I think a formulator is, as much as you have a lot of science, but you also have to be able to create something interesting. Mm-hmm. And that's what the exciting part of our job. We're constantly looking for what is the next texture, you know, and that makes a big difference.
And I do realize that even as just an average consumer, I do take for granted how much work goes into stabilizing a emulsion and just the rheology of a product. And I wanted to ask, when it comes to each age group has a different perception about how they would like their product to feel. When it comes to different companies now currently on the market and they're trying to cater to different age groups, what is your recommendations for like how a company can keep on trend and to just keep researching about what the consumer needs are per group?
I think now the market has changed dramatically in the past, like I would say 20 years, right? Because mm-hmm. people used to go to the store or the drugstore or even the department store, buy their creams and lotion. They read magazines like, you know, different beauty magazine. They got a lot of information from there. These days, the game has changed. You know, people go to like YouTube to look at videos, how people apply stuff. You know, mm-hmm. they have bloggers that say opinion about certain products. There are certain trends that are completely different. People don't even have to go to the store. They get their stuff from Amazon or any other company. They have online deliveries. And the market has changed. So we have to cater now to the new generation, right? And we also have to cater to the older generation, the people who still go to the department stores, you know? So it becomes a little bit more complex. And then again, it goes back to what I said before. You really need to know the age of your consumer, where they get that product from. You know, is they get it from the internet? Do they follow which blogger is popular, right? How can you influence the different bloggers that are out there, you know? And it has changed dramatically, you know, how you keep up with the trends. Because the trends that you can see in the store or in other places are very different from the trends on the internet, you know? So I think that's the job of marketing. They need to keep up with the trends, and R&D as well. You know, you can't be in the dark. You need to know how people apply your product. And it's interesting. So that is something that everybody has to, you know, follow.
Especially in the area of polymer science, because I have noticed that even though it's a slight change, there are consumers who are now becoming more aware about what is in their product, and they're starting to do their own research. Someone actually asked me this question, and I felt that this was appropriate to ask you. What is unique about polymer science? Because this viewer actually mentioned that when they looked at their products and they actually did their research and they discovered this whole realm of polymer science, they actually didn't understand, like, why was it important to know just why certain polymers react with each other. So definitely the more chemistry side of it. So why is it important to know polymer science, and why is it important for formulators to learn and understand and to keep on trend with it as well?
So polymers are basically very large molecules, right? So very large molecule. And I like to, you know, to think about them as like large freight train, you know, these very humongous, right? Mm-hmm. So when you put them in the formula, they don't behave very similar to like smaller molecules, right? Something like if you have a car, right, it can maneuver fast, you can go around this, that, and the other, but with a freight train, you know, has to move slow, has to move at a certain pace, you cannot stop it, right? Mm-hmm. And similarly with polymers, you know, there are certain things that you can't stop it. You know, polymers will influence your cream in a certain way because they're big, they're humongous. They interact with your surfactant, that you interact with your emulsifier. They will have an impact on your texture, you know, because they're big. You cannot miss them when you add them, you know. They will gel your system. They can enhance they will change your rheology of the product, you know. So they're big, you know, molecules that have to be treated, you know, a little different than small molecules, for example, right? They take a very long time to hydrate. So people have to know, okay, which polymer I'm going to add to my formulation, mm-hmm. right? And that's a question that people should ask themselves. You know, what do I want to achieve? Am I looking for stability? Am I looking for film formation? Do I want to put a polymer that form a film on the skin that make it much more elastic? Do I want to put a polymer, you know, that can form that can actually give you water resistance for sunscreen? So why are you putting the polymer, and which polymer I'm going to select? And also, how is it going to interact with the other ingredients in my formulation? So these are questions that are very important for formulator to know. The other aspect of polymers is that polymer from different manufacturer can have the same inky name, but they could be very different, right? Mm-hmm. So, and that is inherent to polymer, not inherent really to ingredients. So a polymer, for example, with a certain inky name, could have a molecular weight, for example, of 100,000 dalton, where the same inky name could have 10,000, right? One polymer could be branched, one polymer could be not branched. So it's very important to know you're buying that particular from a particular manufacturer and may behave a little bit different than the same exact polymer from another manufacturer. So these are key parameters that the formulator should look at when you look at the polymer.
And just after researching during my own time, just different polyquats and different polymers currently even being used on the market, you did bring up a very good point that when it comes to the inky name, it's the same if it has the same name, but the molecular weights are different. And I didn't realize that until I actually did some more in-depth research. So as a formulator, I just per our conversation, I now understand that there is a huge gravity when you're adding a polyquat to any formulation. And just in your experience, when it comes to not just polymer science, but just emulsions, how important is it for a formulator to know just chemistry, to understand the interactions of the molecules at a cellular level?
It's important for the formulator to know how different ingredients interact, because if they can predict how they interact, they can predict what texture they're going to create at the end of the day, right? So that is an important correlation that people have to add. And then again, like I said, formulation is part art, part science, right? So if you don't know the science, you never understand the interaction and why this is happening. You can see it, but you're not going to understand it. And if you don't understand it, you're not going to be able to fix it correctly. You know, some people can take a stab at it, but if you take a stab with a good scientific background, it probably is a better stab than just like, okay, like winging it, you know? Mm-hmm. So as much as you have a lot of creativity and for formulation, but you also need to do a little bit of a scientific background. Okay, if I add a quad, for example, and I have an anionic polymer, what would that happen? You know, mm-hmm. Will it coalesce? Will it enhance stability? Would it be worse? Would it thicken? And then based on that, you make a judgment call. So, okay, I'm going to use this and because I think this is what's going to happen. So you need to know, you need to have a basic understanding of the science behind it when you add things to the formulation. And also you need to be able to predict what kind of texture you're going to create by adding that ingredient. And I think that's the artistic part.
You're right, especially just per my previous conversations with different experts in our industry, they also had that same enthusiasm that cosmetics is just the combination of art and science. And I liked your previous statement that if you don't understand the science, you're really not gonna understand just the art of what you're doing. And this actually leads into my follow-up question is, what would you recommend for new formulators who are going to begin work in emulsions and polymers?
So for new formulators, I recommend them to look at different textures, you know, look at outside, see what people have done in the past, you know, learn. I would recommend people reading articles, scientific articles, maybe once a day. You know, when I was younger, I usually liked to read a lot of articles just to know the science. You know, you don't have to take an exam, but reading an article a day is something that I like to do. Also, you know, when you work with formulation, you should really know, ask your question why you're adding an ingredient, you know, or ask your question why, but also have an answer, right? So if you're saying, I want to add a certain ingredient to your formula, why I want to add it? And what do I want to achieve by adding it? And at the end of the day, I have to look at what I've done and see if I achieved it or not. You know, what's my goal? And if it didn't, then I had my wrong approach or I added the wrong ingredient. Don't add things because someone else told you. You know, just that's not something that I recommend to people. You know, you should know why you're adding things. And science is simple. You know, ask a couple of questions to yourself before you do anything. Why are you adding certain ingredients and what's the outcome or what you predict is going to happen? And that can teach you there is a lot of experience, right? Or you can ask someone, you know, you can come to people who've done this in the past, ask them, why should I add this? Or what do you think we should add and what would happen? You know, simple mm-hmm. questions. And that I think is a good starting point when people start asking themselves questions.
And that's also a good habit. Unfortunately, I mean, I would say I would read scientific papers like once every other month, but that's definitely a good habit to just start, especially since current times we are at home still, we are not really moving about more often, but just to brush up on just past or current or upcoming literature, just to
It's a good habit. Yeah.
Yeah, that is a good habit. So I'm definitely going to incorporate that myself. That is a good habit. My next question is actually, so with the FDA, they do hold a pretty ambiguous stance when it comes to the cosmetics industry and just how we are a industry that is pretty self-regulated. Thank you. We are pretty self-regulated. And in recent months or years, with the whole sunscreen incident, and now upcoming, there are a lot of consumers and even people who are in the industry who do look to the FDA for guidance and just their opinions on different incidents that happen in our industry. And I was curious to know, where do you see the FDA's stance on just claims and claim substantiation? Do you see it changing in like 3 to 5 years or even later?
So I mean, technically, the FDA is in charge of the industry, right? There is a Food and Drug and Cosmetic Act that was enacted many years ago and gives the FDA authority over the cosmetic industry. However, like you said, the cosmetic industry has been self-regulated. Nobody's been, I mean, if they never really bothered to follow the cosmetic manufacturer that much, especially when it comes to claims. Mm-hmm. A couple of times they will come, I think, and then start asking questions if you make extremely bold claims, you know, or you have a safety concern. Mm-hmm. So then they're going to come after manufacturer. But in general, they've never done that. But even claims, they usually left it to FTC to bother people, you know, and FTC regulated it, and they never really had to come in. But there will definitely be, if there is a safety concern of something that came out of the market, or there is a major claim that's just like completely outrageous, you're going to think FDA is going to come and knock on your door. Mm-hmm. Now, with regard to sunscreens are monographed, right? So all the monographs fall under the FDA guidelines. And they have the ultimate authority to approve new sunscreens or take out old ones and stuff like that. So they keep a very close tab on monographs. Now, in general, the FDA still doesn't change monograph much, right? So you have they have like many monographs, you know, the anti-caries, that they don't change them that much. They've been around for years. People followed them, and the FDA didn't bother you if you listen to what claim they ask you to say and stuff like that, and everybody's happy. Mm-hmm. The only thing that had a lot of issue is like, our sunscreen monograph was too old. It was very old. It only contained 20 sunscreen, whereas the rest of the world moved out and added a lot of sunscreen. So that put the FDA in a corner. Okay, you need to approve new ones. Mm-hmm. So they started looking at, you know, what is up, what's in our monograph. They did a couple of studies, and that's what triggered the whole incident of the FDA monograph. But in general, if all the other monographs, the FDA haven't changed any of them. You know, they don't really come and change them. But the sunscreen is a special issue, because now Europe and the rest of the world have a lot of sunscreen to use. We can't, you know, we have to apply for an NDA, and that's too costly. Mm-hmm. And too costly and time consuming, you know, so a lot of companies aren't going to do it, you know, so it's a financial issue. It's not anything else, you know. When you apply for an NDA for a drug, you can sell it for $200. Mm-hmm. You can never sell a sunscreen for $50, you know. So basically, nobody's going to apply for an NDA. So they need to come to a consensus that something should happen. I'm not sure how they're going to solve that problem.
Right. And it is interesting, especially when the issue first broke last year. And I was hopeful that we would see some changes by, well, present day 2021. They still haven't came out with their new plan.
Guidelines. I'm on the PCP team. I worked with them. We developed the formulation that's going to be tested by the FDA and stuff like that. So I'm aware of what's going on. Mm-hmm. But it's a long timeline.
Yeah. And unfortunately, like you said, when it just comes, especially, well, sunscreens, just for the record, I'm pretty sure many viewers know, but sunscreens do, for at least in the United States, fall under the drug category. In many other countries, it is under the cosmetics industry. And I think that's also part of the reason why we have such a slow, rigid process, is because, one, it is monographed, like you mentioned, and two, it is a drug. So there's a lot of tests to have to go into to approving the SPF factor and then just ensuring that the level of absorption into the skin is good.
Non-existent.
And it's just interesting to have this conversation with you about just the FDA and whether or not their views and will change, or if they'll actually make any changes in the near future. I would say I am grateful that it has been acknowledged, and just as a huge sunscreen advocate myself, I will just continue to just wait and just read. And I also encourage other viewers to do so as well, because this is definitely going to impact the industry if we are able to use different UV filters, and to just to have, it'll add a lot more creativity to just your normal SPF.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. So I'm very excited for that. On another note, this is kind of random, but you have such a strong scientific background and you have a lot of experience now in the industry. And I wanted to know, what was your least favorite subject in school?
Oh, I have many least subjects. Trust me. You know, I never liked thermodynamics. You know, it's one of the subjects that I never really enjoyed. It's like chemistry and math together. Mm-hmm. And I was never really big on math. I took math. I like it. I just took it to pass it. I never really took it to love it.
Mm-hmm.
And when you combine it with chemistry, that becomes something that I never enjoyed. However, you know, part of the program is you when you go to college, you have to take a lot of classes that you don't like really. And you know, we all know this, right? We all had some things that we never liked. And especially with my PhD, you know, I only didn't like the first 2 years at all, but nobody asked my opinion. but I like, you know, but at the end of the day, you do something that you like, you know, so you focus on areas that you really like and stuff like this. So I don't have to do it anymore. You just pass it, done.
I appreciate that, because I also don't like math. Math's not really my forte, but it is important.
I tell you something, my two kids love math. So I have to make something wrong.
That's so ironic.
They love math and physics, so which I have no idea where they got that. Maybe my wife, probably something like that.
Yeah, me in math and physics, no, that's definitely not my forte. But I mean, this is actually a follow-up question for just the cosmetics industry. Is physics also important?
Physics is important. Yeah, absolutely. Because if you do sunscreen, you have to know physics, you know, UV lamps, you know, irradiation, you know, solar spectrum. When you do, you know, a lot of measurement needs physics. And I'm lucky that I had to rely on other people to do that for me.
Well, I don't blame you, because I would do the exact same thing.
Yeah, no, but you need expertise. You definitely need expertise. But not everybody knows everything either, because I think people who like physics, they don't like formulation. So that makes my life easy, you know, so I can do my stuff. They do their stuff and we help each other, you know.
And that's great, because that definitely shows that, like what was said just in other conversations that we had, just this is a collaborative effort to bring a product to the market. It's not just R&D. I mean, you have different departments that are working to actually bring something to life. So that is amazing. And on a final note, this is my last question. How confident are you in the direction of our industry now, just with the current trends that are now emerging? How confident are you with the direction that as an industry we are going in?
I think our industry is very solid, and an industry that has went through many changes and survived all of them, right?
Mm-hmm.
And we're always trying to take what the consumer wants and then adapt to it and move past it. You know, many years ago, you know, people were against, for example, formaldehyde donors, you know, people were against, you know, other ingredients. So, oh my God, we can't use that ingredient, the other ingredients, you know, and the cosmetic industry adapted. You know, now we can see a lot more green products. You know, people don't want to use a lot of synthetics, you know, a lot of oil-based products, you know, people don't want to use them. The industry is responding, you know, naturally derived, biodegradable. All these are things that the consumer wants. Companies, you know, they're looking at, okay, how I'm going to make this a little bit more biodegradable? How I'm going to make this more green? You know, how I'm going to do this and that? And everybody's shifting. The shift is not immediate, but the shift is moving. And I think we're constantly changing industry. And that is, you know, that's why you need R&D. That's why you need people in different area. And it's good. It's a good learning. It's a challenge. But if you don't have challenges, then it's not exciting to work, you know?
Right. That is very true. I would say I am also, I definitely do see the shift, like you said, in the direction that our industry is going in. And I do appreciate the changes that are happening. And I am very excited to see where we will stand 10, 15 years from now in terms of claims and different emulsions on the market and even the polymers that like may be used or patented or may be found in different formulations. And that is all for my questions. I want to thank you for joining us. This was a very insightful, very, very insightful conversation. And thank you all for listening. And please continue to listen to our different podcasts. Thank you,
Dr. Thanks. Harris. Thank you very much. Thanks, Nia.
Like what you heard? The NYSCC is here to move cosmetic science forward. Stay tuned to our next episodes and visit nyscc.org for more content.
Hey, Susanna Fernandez here, this year's NYSCC's chair. Don't forget about Suppliers Days, beauty's main event for innovation in ingredients and formulation taking place on November 10th and 11th at the Javits Center in New York City. There will also be a virtual day on Friday, November 12th, to make it accessible for everyone in the industry. We look forward to seeing you there. Visit us at nyscc.org/suppliersday today.